So Ecclesiastes chapter 7, beginning at verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked?
Thank you, Alistair, and thank you, everybody, again, for coming back. It's nice to see you all again. It is so nice to be cooler, isn't it? It's a huge relief. If you're new, if this is the first time you've come, you've missed the first two, just a reminder, or to let you know, and a reminder to everybody that you can go to the Keswick website and get three handouts that accompany the four sessions. And they're, like I said the other day, they're not typical blank space handouts that you fill in notes. They're actually articles on some of the themes in the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you don't want to get the book that I wrote on Ecclesiastes, you want a condensed, summarized version of the book and of these four sessions, you can get all of it. You can probably read it in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you'll be done. It's a 4,000-word article that's on the website. It's called Is All Really Vanity? That's a summary of my first seminar, a kind of overview of the whole book of Ecclesiastes. Is all really vanity? And then there's two other handouts. You do not have much time. And then the one that I'm really basing today and tomorrow on, Let Death Teach You How to Live. So they might be a help to you. We're coming this morning to think about death. And of course, as we do this, we're not thinking about an abstract idea, are we? The first seminar was called Perspective, and it's a little bit out there, a bit esoteric, but death is not like that, is it, for any of us in this room? It's very, very likely that this morning will touch a raw nerve for some of us. I might cry at certain points doing it. You might as well. I know there are open wounds here and difficult things in all our homes and our families, thinking about death. My brother, Jonathan, who lives in America, he and his wife, Jackie, 6 years ago, lost their little daughter at birth, stillborn. And in their family, and therefore in our family, there is a very real wound there that is still taking time to heal in many ways. Thinking about death is not easy for us, is it? And it is so strange for us to open a book in the Bible and for us to be looking so intently at something like death. Ecclesiastes doesn't really let you take your eye off it. You're looking at it constantly from beginning to end. You're looking at it in different ways. So the passage that Alistair read for us, chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes, what is going on when somebody, and I would say a believer, an orthodox upright believer, what is going on when an orthodox upright believer can write chapter 7, verse 1, the day of death is better than the day of birth? Here's what Brian Brock, who's a professor at Aberdeen University, practical theology, Brian says, we need to be alienated from what we think we know in order to genuinely grow. And Ecclesiastes is doing that, isn't it? We We know the first part of verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment. We get that. Reputation matters, and it's an amazing thing when that goes with you through life so that when you enter a room, you're not a bad smell to people. People don't turn their head or turn away from you. But the second half, we don't know what that means, do we? And Ecclesiastes is just alienating us from what we think we know. And if you like, the whole book is a meditation on, it's a meditation on the growth that can happen in your heart in that space when you have become alienated from what you think you already know. So this new space that opens up, the idea that death might be better than birth, in that space, genuine growth is possible. It's the space where what you thought was only awful, only terrible, only a curse, actually has some gifts built into it. I wonder if anybody knows who this man is. Anybody recognize him? Yeah, a lot of people think Senna. It's not Ayrton Senna. This is a man called Alex Zanardi. You can see the quote there. I want to do something with this life of mine. I want to take my life as a great opportunity that I cannot waste. Alex Zanardi won gold 2016 in the Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro. He won gold in the hand cycling event. And the reason he was there competing in those Olympics is because 15 years earlier, as a Formula One race car driver, he lost both his legs in a high-speed car crash in Germany. And when he received his gold medal in Rio, all those years later, Zanardi said this. He said, I feel my life is a never-ending privilege. Even my accident, what happened to me, became the greatest opportunity of my life. Now, I don't know about you, but I sit up and take notice when I hear somebody say words like that. That is not what you expect to happen in a double amputation, is it? There is always something beautiful. There is something disorientating in finding a gift where we only thought we would find tragedy. And I think that is what Ecclesiastes does for us. The tragedy of death is not just a tragedy, but has gifts built into it. So what I want to try and do in this morning and tomorrow morning is to take you through these three things, what I've called the three strange faces of death in Ecclesiastes. Death is a surgeon, and death is a preacher, and then really tomorrow is number three, death is an artist about life. So we're going to think this morning about death as a surgeon and death as a preacher. And this idea of death wearing strange faces to us, it's because what we find in Ecclesiastes is so unexpected. It doesn't mean that the teacher is sugarcoating death, pretending death is not all the other things we believe about death. No, for the teacher of Ecclesiastes, death still stalks the world as a curse. Make no mistake about that. Read chapter 4, the opening verses. Sometimes you look at some things that are just so unspeakably awful, you say it might have been better to not have been born, to not have had to suffer this or experience it. The teacher does not deny everything you already believe about death. But the genius of the book lies in exploring the distinction between death in general, okay, death out there, death in the world, other people's death, and my own death in particular. That's the genius of the book, that there is a distinction between those two things. What difference does it make to my life to think about my coming death? Not death out there and the tragic loss of our loved ones, but my own death in particular. And Ecclesiastes is hammer blow after hammer blow, reminding me that my death is certain, my death is coming. And so meeting that death in advance on the way to it today can actually be one of the greatest gifts that God can give us. We can learn to live by preparing to die. So let's just think about this first one here, about death being a surgeon. I don't have, unlike the second one, death being a preacher that we'll come to in just a moment, I don't have chapter and verse for this to try and prove it to you, unfortunately. This is more an attempt to say that I think this is what the book of Ecclesiastes as a whole is doing in terms of what it feels like, okay? So we know what surgeons do. They operate on human bodies, don't they? And they wound the body and they cut the body in order to heal the body and to make it whole. And I think in Ecclesiastes, death is a cardiologist. The most skillful of heart surgeons, at least in the preacher of Ecclesiastes' hands. And I think the way that that works is because that word in chapter 1, verse 3, that we looked at, the opening passage about the desire for gain, the desire for a surplus, for something left over in life, something I want something to be left over and to last forever because I lived here. The teacher in Ecclesiastes knows that is the great motivating desire of every human being. We want to achieve something and we want to be someone. And the greatest obstacle to that ambition is death. And in grace and mercy, God uses death, I believe in this book, to operate on our heart's anxieties and fears, on our restless striving and straining and toiling for gain, on our striving for greatness, and for a forever after legacy, which actually Ecclesiastes says God has placed that off limits for fallen creatures. So it's been interesting to me listening to Glenn Harrison yesterday. Those of you who heard that lecture in the morning, isn't it interesting that as he was tracing the roots in our culture of why we've got to where we've got to with the obsession about the self, both in the first part and in the second part of his lecture, he kept coming back to Genesis, didn't he, to the serpent's whisper. What did the serpent whisper to Eve? You shall be as gods. You shall be as gods. But actually, death is God's no. You shall not be as gods. Death is God's no to our rebellion. It's God's way of showing us that our coup attempt has failed. It's a failed coup. Here's that quote that I told you about on day one. Somebody came up to me afterwards. Amazingly, there was somebody in the room who came up and said that quote was from Psalm 73 of Derek Kidner's commentary. I think he'd maybe Googled it or maybe had it in his head. I don't know. I can't remember. I'm not surprised if you had it in your head. This has stuck with me ever since I read it. This was the nerve the serpent had touched in Eden to make even paradise appear an insult. Isn't that amazing that world that God gave to Adam and Eve in all its, you know, I mean, we have never seen anything like Eden. And they still said to God, is this it? We want more than this. We want, Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 3, we want gain. We want extra, we want a surplus, we want more than you have given to us. And that divine no of death is what God says to our attempt to rise up above our station. Here's Jacques Ellul. He says, you are a creature, and our problems in our lives, our world, do not stem from our failure to stay in our garden. No, all the evils, and I choose my words carefully, all the evils of the world stem from our taking ourselves to be the creator. That divine no to human beings saying, you will not now live forever, you will die. Ecclesiastes just says, I'm just going to write 12 chapters meditating on what that means. And he discovers that that no is a severe mercy. There is blessing in it, because if you reflect on that no that God has given to you and to me, if you reflect on it in advance, it's God's way of letting you see yourself in Adam and Eve, trying to gain what you are not meant to gain, but it gives you the chance, if you reflect on it in advance, to now not live like they did. What should Adam and Eve have known in the garden? Life is what? Life is gift, not gain. If you want a tagline for Ecclesiastes, my tagline in the book is learning to live by preparing to die. And you say, well, what does that actually mean? It means life is gift, not gain. Life is God giving something to you, not you taking what the world is and striving and striving and striving to be someone, to get somewhere, to do something, to have everything, to know it all and be it all. Life is gift, not gain. I'm going to enjoy what God has given rather than taking and using it for my own ends. And I think the way Ecclesiastes works is just to say that there is a blessing that comes from accepting that you do not need to gain in order to enjoy life. Life is just a blessing packed full of God's good gifts to enjoy. So chapter 1, verses 1 to 11, the opening of the book, chapter 1, verses 1 to 11, uses creation to teach us that we will die. That's the point of the poetry, that everything comes spinning round and round again. And once you have popped off this spinning globe, creation will just keep going and going and going. And then you get from chapter 1, verse 11, creation teaches us that we will die. Then you move into the rest of the book, and the message becomes, because chapter 1, verses 1 to 11 is true, you're going to die, the message becomes, therefore, enjoy what you can while you can. Live the life that God has given you to live and enjoy it. And then at the end, chapter 12, we come back to creation, but we do it in reverse. So just turn to chapter 12, please. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 9. And chapter 12, verses 1 to 9 uses creation to teach us that we will die. It's as if the writer saying, if you haven't got this yet, let's go back to creation again. Just look at this beautiful passage, verses 1 to 9. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street shut. When the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low, they are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails. Because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to the God who gave it. Fleeting, fleeting, says the preacher, all is fleeting. It's amazing, isn't it? After using creation at the opening of the book to tell us that we will die, now we get creation telling us again that we will die. Look at verse 2. This is an amazing set of imagery. The sun, the light, the moon, and the stars. How does creation begin the opening chapters of Genesis? What do all those things do? They give light, don't they? And here at the end, they all go in reverse. They all go dark. Derek Kidner, again, he says that what is happening here, the intensity of the picture, he says that what is happening here is the unmaking of creation as the good and the right order of things is reversed. Just as God made every person, so at the end, in old age and death, every person becomes unmade. Do you notice the intensity of the picture? All the light givers, sun and moon and stars, go dark. And the rain does not give way to daylight, but only to threatening clouds. Derek Kidner says, this is a scene to bring home to us the general desolations of old age. Not only the lights of the faculties and the senses begin to fade, but so too the warm glow of old friends, familiar customs, long-held hopes. Age steals each of them away. Look at this quote from Kidner. All of this will come at a stage when there is no longer the resilience of youth or the prospect of recovery to offset it. In one's early years and the greater part of life, troubles and illnesses are simply setbacks. They're not disasters. You expect the sky to clear eventually. But now in this season of life, it is hard to adjust to the closing of that long chapter. to know that now in the final stretch there will be no improvements, the clouds will always gather again, and time will no longer heal but kill. You see, the way the imagery works in chapter 12 is it moves from a meteorological picture to a domestic picture. We turn from the world's natural slide into darkness, and in the rest of chapter 12, we move into the picture of the fall of a great house into tragic disrepair. And what's happening, I think, in those verses 1 to 9, that the teacher's using the way in which a once magnificent building becomes dilapidated. This pencil factory has done it the other way around, hasn't it? It's gone into reverse in a right way. But you can all know, you've all seen those stately homes, those beautiful once palaces that are now ruined. And verses 1 to 9 is a powerful collection of metaphors and allusions to show that. So that the house has different parts of the house that I think actually then begin to describe the human body as it gets old. So the keepers of the house tremble. Your hands, your arms that were once strong and capable of defending you and providing for others. When you go to the gym, if you're male, what do men work on in the gym? It's arms, isn't it? It's a place of strength. But one day they will grow limp and begin to tremble. The strong men stooping are legs, no longer even able to bear your own weight. Grinders, teeth, I think, windows, eyes, doors, ears. And eventually they each fail, no longer able to chew sufficiently, see completely, or hear perfectly. Do you remember Christopher Hitchens, the famous opponent of the gospel, just before he died, writing in Vanity Fair, he was dying from esophageal cancer. And because he was such a brilliant thinker in so many ways, he was, in the closing moments of his life, he reflected really poignantly on what it was like to lose the ability to speak, so that the particular cancer that he had. And he said, "I've come to see the essential link between speaking and writing. Think of how a writer is encouraged to find your voice." He says this, "such that to lose this ability, to lose my ability to speak, is to be deprived of an entire range of faculty. It is assuredly to die more than a little." And I think, friends, that's what the teacher is picturing here. It's not just that those things are depressing in themselves. That quote, I'm sorry to leave it up on the screen, it is depressing, isn't it? It's not just that these things are depressing. It's that they represent sad degeneration and decline from what once was. Kidner says, "In the brave struggle to survive, there is almost a more pointed reminder of decay than in a total ruin." So if you level the house and get rid of it, it's not as poignant a reminder as the fact that it's standing there decrepit. William Hazlitt said, "We do not die wholly at our deaths." There are ways of dying that are slow, aren't they? And the teacher is saying old age is like that. So what is the surgeon doing at that point? He's doing chapter 12, verse 1, isn't he? "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. While you still can," we're going to look at all of this tomorrow. If this all sounds too depressing for words, please, like I said, day one, come back tomorrow. "While you still can, live. Give yourself to living. And in the midst of it, remember your Creator." And when you put creation teaches us, chapter 1, that we will die, creation, chapter 12, teaches us that we will die, all of it is Ecclesiastes' way of saying to us, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are that you think you're so strong, so capable, so eternal, so going to achieve so much? No, one day all your greatest strength will go into reverse. Let death simply operate on your heart, on your ambitions, on your goals, your greatest desires. But a little bit more concretely, let's do death as a preacher. This is the second thing. And this is chapter 7 that Alistair read for us. "A good name is better than precious ointment. And the day of death better than the day of birth. Like I've said several times, that is so striking, isn't it? And when I was wrestling with it, I listened to lots of different commentators, preachers. One of the most common ways of reading it was for people to say it must mean that we have to read this through the lens of being a Christian, which of course is true, isn't it? And it must mean that Philippians, the letter to the Philippians, it must mean that to die and to be with Christ is better. This must be an early indication of that. Being with Christ is the fulfillment of chapter 7, verse 1. But actually, I don't think that's true, of course, is it? But I don't actually think it's what the teacher is getting at. It's actually right there for us in verse 2, isn't it? What does it mean that the day of death could be better than the day of birth? It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Look at verse 4. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. See, I think what he's getting at here is, take the idea of birth. Okay, if any of you have ever had the privilege of yourselves or a family going to a maternity ward where everything has gone well and the baby has arrived and mum and dad are ecstatic and grandparents are ecstatic, and there's little better in life than that, is there? That amazing time in a family's life. That moment in the maternity ward where everything has gone well, how can the funeral at the end of life in any way be better than this? I think what the teacher is getting at, if you think about his language here of in verse 2, this is the end of all mankind and the living will lay it to heart. The way that I've tried to express it in the book is that I think the teacher is saying that the coffin at the end preaches better sermons than the cot at the beginning. Okay, so the new baby, the day of birth, you hold little Jemima and everybody's looking at her, but what can you say about her? I mean, what's the most you can say? Like, she's got her mum's nose, or, you know, everybody's making it up, aren't they? Just a shriveled up little prune. And she means the world to everybody, but she hasn't done anything. She's just arrived. She's just loved for the sheer fact of her existence. But now you fast forward 80 years to Jemima's death. What is there to say about her? In pastoral ministry, I thought Alistair Begg's stuff, if you were at the Bible reading, about Onesiphorus and the choice, you know, he's obsessed with graveyards, isn't he? And what graveyards say about a person, that I find it really beautiful in church life, the idea of being a Mr. Smith, not a Mr. Jones. What was it he said? Mr. Jones' objection was minuted. That made me smile. Imagine that being said about you at the end of your life. Here's Jemima now, who's lived 80 years, and it's her body in the coffin. What will people say about her? I mean, what are the options? She loved her knitting. She loved bingo. She loved her garden. That's it. That's all she did. And any of you who've done parish type of funerals, you will know often that is all there is to say. That's the sum total of a life. She was just here, didn't do very much. She left. Or she loved Christ with a full, glad, happy heart. She gave herself away to others. Her family loved her. The church thrived because of her. All the things that Alistair was talking about that's possible to do in life because of who you are as a person and what you've seen about God and the gospel and all the things that you can do with your life. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. This is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. See, the teacher knows in verse 4 that at the funeral, there are always two types of person sitting in the crematorium, aren't there? There is the wise mourner and there is the foolish mourner. And the foolish mourners, there in verse 4, he is thinking, She is thinking, I'm glad I got a couple of hours off work to go to this funeral, but I cannot wait to get out of this and to go back to the pub tonight, to the football. But the wise person, what's the wise person doing at the funeral? Staring at the coffin, realizing one day that will be me. And when it's me, what will they say about me? What will my life have amounted to? See, it's a really, really powerful picture, isn't it? Just recently, not in the UK, but somewhere else that I visited, I spoke at an evangelistic dinner that was the most amazingly well thought out evangelistic event I've ever been part of. A group of Christian businessmen have started a weekly event called Whiskey and Wisdom. And Christian businessmen, they get together, they love whiskey, they drink some nice whiskey, and they discuss a proverb. And they find that in their business world, non-Christian colleagues, they've got everything. These are people with money, power, influence, but what they know they're lacking is wisdom. And they find that reading Proverbs become incredibly powerful evangelistically. They invite their friends, and this group began to grow so much that they thought they'd put on a dinner. So we had this amazing for lots of reasons, a night called Whiskey and Wisdom. And I did 5 short talks from the book of Ecclesiastes on some of these themes, time, life, death. But the chap who'd organized it curated the whole event so that with every one of the 5 talks, there was a prop. Okay, so my talk on time, I began with Forrest Gump's words, life is like a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get. And this guy had put a box of chocolates under everybody's seat in the room. So as I was saying that, they were meant to look under their chair and get out the box of chocolates and, you know, stuff you'd never think of doing. We discovered that when the time came to do that, because it was all men in the room, some of the men even before the meal, had taken the box out. They'd already eaten the whole box of chocolates. And the whole point of it was they were meant to take it home and give it to a special person at home or something. But when we came to this one, death, what my friend had done to all the people in the room, it was 36 people, and he knew all of them. They were all his business colleagues. What he had done is he'd got a photograph of them, just Googled it, got a photo, and he'd printed it out. And as I was doing the talk on death, he was walking around giving it to each of them. And we asked them to put it on the table in front of them. And the talk said to them, one day a room like this will be gathered, and we will be looking at your photo on a page. So some of you were there on Sunday afternoon. I wasn't at it, but I've seen the order of service for Peter Maiden's life, the service of Thanksgiving. There's Peter Maiden's face on the front. What will your life amount to when it comes to be you that we're speaking about? That's the amazing challenge of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? Death is a preacher. Death is speaking to us, saying that I'm coming. One day you will meet me. So while you live, how are you living? And I think, friends, we can hear death preaching to us, not just by thinking about our own death coming down the line at us in the future, but we can hear death preaching to us from the lives of other people who have been shaped by death very profoundly. It's another way in which you can benefit from the house of mourning. Spend time with people who have lived in the house of mourning and seen what they have seen about life from the house of mourning. So I don't know if any of you have heard of this man, Gerald Sitzer. Gerald Sitzer wrote this wonderful book that's on the screen here called A Grace Disguised. And what happened to Gerald Sitzer in 1991? Gerald Sitzer in rural Idaho, he was driving his car with his wife, his 4 children, and his mother, and their car was struck by a drunk driver. And in a single moment, he lost his wife, his mother, and his 4-year-old daughter. And in the aftermath of that, Sitzer wrote this profoundly beautiful book, Reflections on Loss and Sorrow, A Grace Disguised. And his reflections, of course, as you would expect, they, They portray an unspeakable agony from the inside of it, don't they? But while also powerfully describing how he and his surviving children began to piece their lives back together again. I picked up a copy of Grace Disguised at Word Alive when I was a student. I read it then, found it astonishingly moving. But I recently discovered that the cover that you're looking at is the second edition of the book. And in the second edition, many years later, Gerald Sitzer now had the opportunity to comment on how far he and his children had traveled since the time that he first wrote the book. And in the preface to the second edition, he says this. He says, "My rawness and utter bewilderment have given way to contentment and deep gratitude. My story has turned out to be redemptive, not only for me and my children, but for many other people as well." And then he says this, and friends, this is Ecclesiastes chapter 7, and this made me sit bolt upright as I read it. "As strange as it might sound, I wish that every man could experience what I have, although without the acute suffering." Now, look at the title of that book, what I told you the accident was. The fact that he was ever able to describe his trauma as a grace disguised, isn't that remarkable? But that he is now standing in a place where he has received from death the kind of gifts that he wishes he could share with other people. Now, that is surely a profound surprise, isn't it? And you'll need to read that book to find out what those gifts are. It's what happens, isn't it, that people who survive catastrophic loss, they say, don't they, that I've seen this in my own family in a small way, that people who survive it say that the only way you survive it is to somehow take it right down deep into you so that it stretches your heart almost to breaking point. But now that it has stretched it, you just find that there's more room in it. More room in it for life, for other people. More room in it for the gifts that God gives. Gerald Sitzer even writes in the book of the sickness of the soul that can only be healed through suffering. I think death has the capacity to teach us things about love and joy that we could actually only learn because of death. Now, that doesn't mean that learning those things is lovely or joyful at the time or the experience of it, does it? There's another profoundly beautiful book by a Christian philosopher, Nicholas Walterstorff. And he has a book called That Are Meditations, Lament for a Son. He lost his 25-year-old son. And some of his laments in the book are some of the most moving evocations of grief that I've ever read. Again, though, looking at Walterstorff's book, he comments at the start of the book on another father's strange habit of giving this book about the loss of his son. This father reads the book and gives the book to his own sons. And Walterstorff says he thought this was profoundly strange to give a book on lament to a son. But then he says he realizes that the father has done this because Walterstorff's book is a love letter to his son. It's precisely why that book is so powerful and so painful. Lament expresses love, doesn't it? That's why the Psalms of Lament have all the feeling that they have in them. It's the psalmist's love for God that is creating the pain that he's feeling. Why, Lord? Why this? What a book like that shows us is that somebody else's lament, this is why the father gives it to his own son, somebody else's lament can give voice not just to your grief, but to your love. Somebody else's lament can teach you the language of your heart, which maybe you didn't even know. Friends, I think in Ecclesiastes, death puts on a preacher's robe. Preachers don't wear robes anymore, do they? But we know that image, the Genevan gown, the thing that the preacher puts on to mask himself so that all you see and hear is God himself speaking to you. Death puts on the preacher's robe in Ecclesiastes to teach us that life is finite and that we must use it well. Death leans down from a lectern or a pulpit to impress on us that the people we love are finite and we must love them well. So I think the sermons that death preaches, if we choose our sermons wisely, the sermons that death preaches can tell us more about the way we love and the way we live than we ever actually realize is going on while we love and we live. Death is a surgeon. Death is a preacher. And I'm actually going to leave it there for today. I'm going to try and bring us back with all the good news tomorrow about death, death as an artist. And I do want to try and encourage you. That third one is just as real as one and two. There are many things in Ecclesiastes where the painful scalpel of point one and the hard-hitting words of point two actually now issue into an entirely different way of living. So I finished earlier than I thought I would, which gives us this morning plenty of time for questions. If anybody would like to do that, I'm very happy to do that. I need to get, as those of you who've come up to me to ask me questions have discovered, I'm not, I may often say I don't know and I'll think about it and I'll come back to you. I'm not good on my feet, but I'm really happy to take questions if you'd like to. Sure, okay. I'll do that. Can we use that mic, Alistair, for people to... Oh, there's a mic here at the back. There's two mics. Alistair's got one, and we've got one here as well. Any questions from folks at all? Yes, sir.
There seems to be no concept of an afterlife in Ecclesiastes. Which I have to confess I only read through this morning, so I may have read it too quickly, but I couldn't sort of see very obviously a concept of an afterlife, and I wonder whether you'd like to comment on that.
Sure. The question is, there doesn't seem to be any afterlife in Ecclesiastes. I think you're basically right. Chapter 3, I said in my heart with regard to the children, God is testing the... You're just like animals. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. It's the same as a dog. Your dog will die. You will die. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. There are two things to say. Number one, we need to qualify that with the fact that, as we've seen, he nevertheless still believes God will judge the righteous and the wicked. So whatever he knows there is death coming to all, but there is justice coming to all. There is judgment. And I think at the very least that is going to imply some conception of afterlife, some way in which, however, whatever he knew, whatever he believed, in some way in which, yes, you might die, you might go to the ground the way that the dog does, but look at chapter 12, verse 13. The end of the matter all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And I think what we can do is say that we can take that hope that judgment is coming and realize that then in the book of Ecclesiastes, when he says, look, a dog and a human, you both, it's the same, you both die. That is a true statement without being an absolute statement. In other words, it's not the only thing that there is to say about death. It's phenomenologically, observably true, and yet there's judgment, and then when you put Ecclesiastes in the shape of the whole Bible, we know that there's even more.
In Ecclesiastes 3:14, it says, but I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's helpful.
I very much benefited from your book. However, I got a sense I didn't really understand a key point of it. You make the point that it's better to look at life from the standpoint of our death, rather than start from where we are and then look forward. But I couldn't quite comprehend how that actually works out in practice of, okay, I'm going to die. But then when I'm 22 or 32 or 42 or 52, how should I then live?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. That's exactly what we want, isn't it? It's the kind of, okay, this is all very well, but what actual difference does it make? Well, so in the book, at one point, I can't remember where it is now, I talk about how I think as human beings and as people at different stages of life, we all have different ways of wishing our life away. So the illustration I give in the book, I guess you don't wish your life away when you're older. You wish you could go back to what you had. When you're younger, at certain points, you wish your life away in the sense that you think, if only I could get this, then life would be better. So the illustration I give in the book is of a particular time. I wasn't very good with small children, and God gave me four of them. Fortunately, he gave me an amazing wife at the same time, but I wasn't great with small children. I remember constantly thinking, when can you have a rational conversation? They're now teenagers. I discovered you still can't have a rational conversation. And I realized, well, they were all little, or some of them were little, while we were doing Ecclesiastes, and I realized I was wishing my life away with them. I was thinking, tomorrow will be better. When they're bigger, this will be, tomorrow will be better, the next stage will be easier, the next day will be better. And one particular outing, we were walking down a road and the wheels were coming off. I was with just two of my kids, the wheels were coming off in a big way, and a neighbor could see that I was not in a good way and the kids were not in a good way. And as we walked past them, the neighbor said to me, "These are the best days of your life." And And he's not a Christian. He was right, wasn't he? Because I'm walking down the road thinking tomorrow will be better, my kids. And Ecclesiastes says you might not be here tomorrow. You do not, chapter 9, chapter 11 we're going to look at, you do not know your time. So when I know that I'm going to die, I stop taking people for granted. I stop thinking that tomorrow I can put that relationship right. I stop thinking that tomorrow I can share the gospel with my non-Christian neighbor. I stop thinking that next year I'll be able to do the thing that I really want to do. I stop saying to my kids, "I'm too busy right now. We'll do that another time." I stop constantly trying to construct my life to be about me and what I want and my empire and my goals and my ambitions. At the end, like I said the other day about Deborah James, that woman who died recently, at the end, it's so striking if you find her writing in the Times about her death that she knows is now days, weeks away. It is all about people. Her whole life has come into crystal clear focus about relationships. So it's chapter 3, life is relational. I put my focus on the people that God has given me. I put my focus on doing today what I can because I might not have tomorrow. And I think I'm going to try and show you this tomorrow. I think people who know that they are dying, and this is Deborah James, people who know that they are dying are usually of all people the most alive. Isn't that right? It's the what did she do? But what was she famous for before she died? Campaigning, fundraising. Does that help at all? I know it doesn't put flesh on all the bones, but it's the kind of, yeah. We've got a question here. Sorry, we'll come to you next year.
It's not so much a question as a comment. The thing that was going through my mind all the time you were talking are the words of that hymn, "The strife is o'er, the battle done, now the victor's crown is won." And that seemed to be coming back and back and back to me. In other words, and what are you doing with your life? What have you done? And which is what you've just been saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. We had a question here, I think, at the front. Alistair, and then there was one at the very back. I saw a gentleman down there.
Not so much a question, again, a comment. When you were talking about a funeral and the person will be in the coffin and what do other people think of your life, what came to my mind was surely it should be what does God think of our life?
Yeah.
And if we live our lives thinking, gosh, what are people going to think at my funeral? Aren't we even getting into the game of, a bit like social media, worrying what people think about us?
Sure.
Because nobody at any funeral will ever know how you lived your life. It will never summarize it. So that came into my life. The other quick comment I've got is people that have been very ill and have nearly died and have been through that experience, I think sometimes have a different concept maybe in terms of how they pursue their lives because they've been so close to it. And that's perhaps relevant to this subject.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I mean, particularly the first bit, I totally take that on board. You shouldn't hear me saying that's why we should be living for what other people think about us. It's for us as Christian people, when it's me at the end, will people have seen that I love the Lord Jesus Christ more than anybody else, more than anything else, and all that flowed from that? In Ecclesiastes language, it's, at the end, will my life have been wise? And what is wisdom in Ecclesiastes? It's fear God and keep his commandments. Know that judgment is coming.
Is this working? Oh, yeah.
It is, yeah. Can I hear you?
I've got two questions. Firstly, that totally makes sense, like how living in the light of death is the best way to live. But I have no idea how to actually do that because I don't naturally think that way. I think, I make my life about me and sort of assume that I'm just going to carry on. And then secondly, how I'm a bit confused by how death can be a good thing as a preacher and a surgeon when it is biblically such a bad thing.
Yeah, thank you. Two really great questions. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
How old?
Yeah.
20.
And do you know yet what you want to do? Forget the Ecclesiastes stuff and what we've been thinking. Do you know yet what you want to do with your life?
Not very clearly, no.
Okay. So I would say that I'm going to do this tomorrow. I've put so much hope into tomorrow for you all, haven't I? But look at chapter 11, verse 9 of Ecclesiastes. Okay, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Is there an old person in the room today who thinks, when I was young, I really knew how to rejoice in my youth? Like I really, really properly 100% didn't take it for granted. I don't think there is there? It's like my son when I say to him, look, enjoy, Archie, you're not going to have this forever, enjoy it. And he can't comprehend it. Because he thinks he will have it forever. It's an old person telling a young person, you're not going to have this forever. And all he's ever known is strength. And the teacher says, what your grandparent is saying to you, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. If by the time you're 21 or 22, whenever it is, you know what it is you want to do, friend, do it with all your heart. Throw yourself into it. Give yourself to it completely. Don't live any day lazily, unwisely, foolishly, not loving the Lord Jesus in that day. Live every single moment for him, with him. And that, for many people, hopefully that means some form of Christian ministry, whether it's full-time or part-time. For many people, it doesn't mean any of those things, whether it's ministry or a non-full-time ministry job that you're doing. Give yourself to it completely. Rejoice in it. And I don't think chapter 11, verse 9, Who's ever heard a whole sermon on Ecclesiastes 11 verse 9 in a church telling young people to rejoice in being young? I mean, I do the park run with my kids now, and I wish I'd done things like that much earlier, because I'm doing them now because I'm in permanent midlife crisis mode. And I loved sport when I was younger, but I look back and I think I didn't love it enough. I could have done way more than I'd done, and I wish I'd done more. The things that you can do because you're young, do them. Give yourself to it completely. Don't do any of them without Christ. Don't do any of them unwisely. Don't do any of them foolishly. Don't do any of them purely just for yourself. I'm going to say this again tomorrow, but it's such a good line. It's worth giving you over 2 days. There's the famous saying, you know, that people say, the non-Christian says, life is uncertain, so eat dessert first. Take the best there is, and while you're young, get on with it, enjoy it. That is not the message of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you do not know what disaster may happen on earth. Seven is the number of perfection in the Bible. Eight is the number of perfection and one more. So we would say today, give a portion to the nth degree. So the Christian way is not life is uncertain, so eat dessert first. The Christian way, friends, is life is uncertain, so give your dessert away. Give yourself away to other people. Give yourself to God and his gospel, and your life will be wise. Does that help at all? That was the first. I've forgotten your second question.
It was just how death biblically is such a bad thing. It's an enemy. And it's something that needs to be defeated.
Yeah, sorry, that's right. So how can one and two be true when death is my surgeon and preacher, when death is so bad? I think the thing there is the thing that I said to the gentleman here, that what I'm saying in Ecclesiastes, hopefully what I'm saying is a true statement about death, but it's not an absolute statement. And we're very good in our Christian thinking of absolutizing certain things at the expense of others. So we have traditionally, most people would agree, we have neglected the wisdom literature in our churches. Not often preached from, not often studied, lived. We're much more comfortable in narrative and epistle, gospel. And the wisdom literature kind of languishes. And what that has meant is, we have absolutized two main strands of the Bible's teaching about death. Genesis, it is a curse. And Philippians, the other parts of the Bible, it is a blessing to be with Christ. Those two things, we've pulled them up and sort of hung everything on them. And we've kind of neglected this extra strand, which is not in contradiction with either of those two, but is just a way of saying, yes, we all know death is a curse. We know it is a blessing to be with Christ. But to think about your own death in advance can be a blessing. So that's the key thing to bear in mind. It's holding different things together, seeing that they cohere. And I do want to keep stressing that even in Ecclesiastes, he knows death is a curse. Make no mistake, he knows that. But it's my death that is where the thinking about me dying is where the blessing can be for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Should we do one more and then
last one
and then finish? Yep. I'll catch you afterwards. There's one at the back, I think.
When I read the Bible, I want to try and see Jesus, I guess, in the pages, and it's harder in Ecclesiastes. Do you have any advice, or do we wait till tomorrow?
Tomorrow's do or die, isn't it? No, it really is. I think, like I tried to say in the first session, I think rightly or wrongly, my way of seeing Christ in Ecclesiastes is probably a bit different from the way that some people have done it, which is to say, life without Christ is meaningless and vanity and empty. And when you come to Christ, you find all those things. Because partly, I think, in practice, we know that some people, their pain and suffering in life doesn't begin until they come to Christ. So when they become a Christian, life was fine. You remember Rosaria Butterfield, and she talks about her conversion experience from being professor of queer theory. She was happy, and when she met Jesus, she says, it was a train wreck. And the pain follows after. And some people... So I'm trying to not have a wooden Christology. I think you find Jesus in Ecclesiastes when you find him groaning at the Pharisees, at illness, at sickness, at death. The teacher is groaning in a Romans chapter 8 way that creation is groaning, and the Lord Jesus groans too. Jesus begins to put creation into the order it was always meant to be when he heals the man in Mark 7. The people say he has done everything well, which is an echo of Genesis. It's like creation being restored. So I find Christ in Ecclesiastes in that it makes me long for the new creation that only he can bring in. I find Christ in Ecclesiastes in the way that the teacher just keeps saying judgment is coming. And what does Jesus say constantly throughout his teaching? Judgment is coming. What's the point of fearing a man who can remove your life when God can cast you into hell? Does that help at all? Is that, yeah. We'll stop.
Do you want to lead us in a final prayer?
Sure, let me pray. Yeah, of course. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this chance to think together about this wonderful part of the Bible that continues to perplex us and amaze us. And this morning in particular, we want to bring to you the groaning of this world in which we live, the news around us, the groaning of our own hearts and lives, the longing that we have for those we love who don't know you, the fear of judgment to come. We shelter this morning in the wonder of the fact that for us, judgment brings joy, the knowledge that when you return to judge the earth, Lord Jesus, our King, the very trees of the field will clap their hands, the oceans will rise up and cry out with joy, for you come to judge the earth. Thank you that you know each of us, you know where we are with you, and so we pray that you would help us to bring to you our righteous, just, holy judge, all that we feel today, to give it to you and to trust you until that day when we see you and are with you forever. In your name we pray. Amen.